with KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 2012, President Obama and the Pentagon unveiled the launch of a commemoration of the Vietnam War to run through the 50th anniversary of the conflict in 2025. Thousands of events are to be organized, including school visits by veterans, special educational curricula, and prisoner of war missing in action ceremonies. But what's the basis for the commemoration of a war that many Americans recall with disgust? In the American War in Vietnam, Crime or Commemoration, which is published by Monthly Review Press, historian and activist John Marciano revisits the war, tracing its history and the motivations of the United States. He methodically goes through the tropes of how the war and opposition to it have been remembered, from the notion that anti-war protesters spat on returning soldiers to the conventional wisdom that the mainstream media opposed the war, and dismantles them one by one. Marciano, who's professor emeritus at SUNY Cortland, joins me today. John, I'd like to begin by asking you about Obama's official commemoration of the Vietnam War. What premise about the morality of the war is it based on?
The fundamental premise is to shape the consciousness of the American people, particularly younger people, to end up supporting the dominant position in the war. As you know from some of the material, there are major objectives, and I think three of them, as I've indicated, stand out: to thank and honor the veterans of the war and their families, particularly those who were held prisoner or missing in action, to highlight the advances in technology, science, and medicine related to military research, and to recognize the contributions and sacrifices of the Allies. It's really now, I think, to shape the memory. This is sort of the ideological struggle, to shape the memory of people here about what happened about the war, and I think really to revise the actual history of the war.
Why are history and memory such an important battleground politically, and what are the stakes here?
Well, I think it's an important battleground because essentially the shooting war is over. It ended in 1975. An additional war continued, an ideological, political, economic war against the Vietnamese for another 20 years because of the embargo. And it's absolutely critical because the insights that people gain from previous conflicts will shape their views on current wars. And as you know, of course, given the greater Middle East, the United States has been involved. Well, Obama's bombed or droned seven predominantly Muslim and or Arab countries. So the issue is we can't go back to redo the Vietnam War. The issue is how are insights going to shape what we do now. And I should indicate that in a way the shooting war has continued in Vietnam and of course Laos, because about 100,000 people in Vietnam alone have been killed or wounded by unexploded ordnance in that country. And actually there are Vietnam vets from the United States who've worked on Project Renew and other projects in Vietnam to help clear that ordnance with the Vietnamese. So I guess one could say that the shooting war has continued.
Well, what seems strikingly missing from the point of this commemoration, as you've enumerated it, is the human and environmental toll of the war, especially on the Vietnamese side. And I wonder if you could give us a sense, to the degree that it's possible, of the scale of that toll, environmentally and in terms of human life.
Well, there have been different estimates, of course, of the death toll in Vietnam alone. And the focus of this book and a previous book I did with my late colleague at SUNY Cortland, Bill Griffin, the focus was on Vietnam because we felt it would be simply too much to also discuss Laos and Cambodia. These are important in and of themselves. But historian Nick Terse argues that the most accurate death toll in Vietnam is based on a Harvard University of Washington study, and that was 3.8 million people in Vietnam killed, millions more wounded, approximately 20 million gallons of herbicides sprayed on the country. The Indochina newsletter estimated some years ago that there were about 14 million refugees in the country. So the human toll is staggering. The environmental toll, of course, from Agent Orange, the deaths and deformities and diseases that have affected the Vietnamese people, and, of course, U.S. GIs. Over decades, they're now seeing deformed kids still in Vietnam. And this was the subject of a book by a dear friend that you probably know, Fred Wilcox, former professor at Ithaca College, who wrote a wonderful book called, a wonderful but very distressing book called Scorched Earth. Fred went back to Vietnam to investigate what was happening, and went to various hospitals and clinics. He also wrote the seminal book on what happened to American GIs waiting for an army to die in 1982. So the deaths and this devastation, the refugee crisis, the dislocation of that country, is staggering. It was that part of Vietnam, particularly South Vietnam, and also Laos, were the most bombed places in human history.
The way that Obama framed the commemoration, which didn't address, as we just mentioned, the human environmental toll on the Vietnamese side in Indochina more broadly, did focus on the pain for American veterans, with the notion that the war was a painful experience, but ultimately it was an honorable one, and that the cause was a noble one. What is the history of that idea in the United States? Because you argue that it is not particular simply to the Vietnam War.
Well, given that this notion of America, the exceptional nation, America, the chosen people, I mean, it really goes back to the Puritan time and the city on the hill. You can go all the way through U.S. history, from our War of Independence to the War of 1812 to Mexico, and then onward into the Cuban Independence War in the Philippines, and then Woodrow Wilson's pronouncements in World War One. It's an absolute fundamental principle that comes to us in terms of Vietnam, most graphically with Ronald Reagan in 1980, who said, "It is time we recognize that ours, in truth, was a noble cause." That essentially the argument is that the United States is a unique force for good in the world. Now, if you look at U.S. history, which was forged in the enslavement of millions of black people, was forged by genocidal attacks on indigenous nations that were here, beginning again at, you know, right in Massachusetts, and moving across the country to California and here in Oregon, where the attacks on Native Americans were horrendous. And what I try to do in the book is just look at U.S. history as objectively as possible, citing other historians to suggest that that's a monstrous lie. Anyone who knows anything about U.S. history, beginning, even if you begin in 1776, knows that it's simply not true. And so Vietnam, the war in Vietnam has to be orchestrated as part of this process. It has to be seen as a noble enterprise, which for quite a while, beginning in the 70s, was not the position of the American public, who actually, by more than 50%, sometimes higher, thought it was an immoral war, which is something unheard of in U.S. history. So that's part of the commemoration. And it's an honorable enterprise that went wrong. The premises were fine, it just didn't work. And of course, that began to shift, particularly after the Tet Offensive in early 1968.
I'm speaking with John Marciano. He is the author of The American War in Vietnam. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So that notion of the Vietnam War being a noble cause, being honorable, filters down in various ways and shapes what you see as a lot of myths that have now been perpetuated about the Vietnam War, some which have their roots at the time of the conflict and some which have unfolded afterward. And I want to ask you about a number of those myths. One of those is around the ill treatment that returning U.S. soldiers purportedly got at the hands of the anti-war movement in the U.S. In particular, the iconic image conjured up is that of anti-war protesters spitting on returning soldiers. To what extent is this rooted in any kind of fact?
Well, according to Jerry Lemke, who's written a seminal book on this called Spitting Image, there is no basis. It's not that in a country of 200 plus million at that time, there may not have been a single incident of someone in the anti-war movement doing that. But in terms of all of his research, checking stories, looking back at the media at that time, which had there was no inkling whatsoever. Lemke, by the way, is a Vietnam veteran, a medic in Vietnam. So he was in combat. He's also featured in a wonderful documentary about GIs and the GI anti-war movement called Sir, No Sir, which is, I would argue, binds one of the most powerful documentaries, if not the most powerful one of that era, particularly around the military anti-war movement. He indicates things, for example, that people would be interviewed to say that when they landed at San Francisco Airport, there were all these anti-war protesters who spit on them. Points out that GIs coming back from Vietnam did not land. No one landed at San Francisco Airport. They landed at Travis Air Force Base. And all these bases were off limits to anti-war protesters. I should indicate in terms of a personal reflection on this. While I was in the anti-war movement as a graduate student during the late 60s, my brother, who was drafted, was in combat with the 5th Mechanized Division in the northern province of South Vietnam. And I couldn't imagine myself or anyone else that I've ever known among hundreds and hundreds of people and literally hundreds of demonstrations where we were absolutely gratified to have veterans join those demonstrations as the anti-war movement grew and grew. My brother's tour duty was cut short because our dear family friend in Rochester, New York, was killed in action, and the family asked the Army to allow my brother to escort the body back to the United States. My brother's probably alive because of that. He had a few months left on his tour. He was in a very, very difficult place in Vietnam, so he was allowed to finish his tour. So Lemke's work, among others, and very careful historical work since then has shown that these are either vastly exaggerated or they simply were made up and then passed along. And these kinds of recollections, by the way, did not emerge in the late 60s and 70s. They began to emerge in the 1980s, the same way the whole POW/MIA issue emerged. So I would just urge your listeners to read Lemke's book. It's a wonderful book, and to really think about this and examine the evidence.
Well, let me ask you about the prisoner of war missing in action myth that you talk about. Are American prisoners of war still being held captive in Indochina, as has been alleged by people, including President Obama?
Absolutely not. That may even be the biggest lie of the war, and that lie was absolutely demolished by H. Bruce Franklin, who was a Vietnam era veteran. He was in the Strategic Air Command. He wrote a book called MIA POW, or maybe POW MIA, and really went through the history of this and the way this issue, which of course was deeply, touched deeply with the families of veterans who were missing in action, disproportionately, most of them, by the way, flyers, pilots. He traced this as well, the way Lemke did with the spitting image. This issue was milked for a long, long time, beginning with, the efforts of Ross Perot in the 1980s. I actually was milked long before that. It began under Richard Nixon. It was continued under Carter, continued under Reagan. And, of course, as you know, in terms of popular culture, the Rambo movies and other movies about efforts to free GIs who were left in Vietnam after the war. This is one of the most... and also because it hit so hard for the people who did lose their loved ones in this war, it's absolutely monstrous, absolutely monstrous. And even John Kerry and John McCain, veteran and also POW, finally bringing together a Senate committee to investigate this, there is simply no evidence. It's just fantastical.
One of the enduring tropes of the war is that of working class support in the United States for the war in Vietnam, and the notion that the anti-war movement was populated by upper middle class students and that working class people stood in opposition to them and supported the Vietnam War. How true is that?
Well, originally, of course, beginning... I guess you would say beginning with the one of the great lies of the war, the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident on August 4th, 1964, and drawing on a whole history where the American population, American citizens, tend to support a president in times of crisis. There was wide-scale support, but not to the extent that we have learned. For example, except for Barry Goldwater in 1964, who was absolutely crushed by Lyndon Johnson in the election, every president essentially ran on a peace platform, and that included Richard Nixon. If you remember, in 1968, he was going to bring peace with honor. He kept telling us he was going to have peace in 1972. Of course, the Nixon and Kissinger helped drag on the war for another 6 years. Then Nixon resigned, and Ford continued. People in the United States voted overwhelmingly. It was the greatest electoral triumph in history to that point for Lyndon Johnson, who told us that he was, it was Asian boys who were going to have to support this war. And another study by a labor studies scholar, Penny Lewis, who wrote a book about hard hats, hippies, in the anti-war movement, showed that as the war developed, increasingly there was working class opposition. Many people forget that that working class opposition emerged very powerfully in the military, which was disproportionately working class. That's who was in Vietnam for the most part, whether they were drafted or whether they volunteered because they did not want to be drafted. So the image was there were just basically elitist students from, you know, Harvard and Yale and, of course, Berkeley and the University of Wisconsin, et cetera, et cetera. They were against the war. The upper middle class was against the war. The liberal media was against the war, which is another monstrous myth of the war, and that working people overwhelmingly were for the war. Well, when they did, when they had referenda in different cities, including I think the first was in Dearborn, Michigan, the opposition to the war correlated closely with one's educational background. Those from the working class with the fewest years of schooling actually were the strongest opponents of the war, as opposed to those who were from the upper middle class who had the most education. Now, that did not mean that the early demonstrations against the war, the activism against the war, the militants against the war involved working people. That part of it certainly early on came out of the campuses. But Penny Lewis, in her book, again, demolishes this notion so that as if there's this elitist group somehow is seeing through the lies of the Vietnam War, and working people are just, you know, yahoos and supporters and unthinking patriots. That's simply not true. There was a growing anti-war movement within the rank and file of unions, as opposed to leadership of the AFL-CIO. George Meany was president during those years, and he was as militant a hawk as anybody could be. That was not the case for unions down the line.
I want to ask you in a moment about the media coverage, which you've alluded to in passing, but tell us more about the extent of the anti-war movement within the U.S. military, something that's certainly not taught in schools or in the histories that have come down from the Vietnam War. What did it look like? How significant was it? What impact did it have on the fate of the war itself?
Well, the first resistance to the war, of course, was not a movement, but was represented by individuals. In the film, Sir, No Sir, there's a long interview with Dr. Howard Levy, who was a captain and was supposed to teach certain medical practices to Green Berets who were going to go to Vietnam. He refused to do it. He was court-martialed. He spent 3 years in prison. There were a group of young recruits. I think they may have been they were at Fort Hood in Texas. They were called the Fort Hood Three. They refused assignment to Vietnam. There were a number of not organized examples of GIs beginning to resist this war. But the organized effort came in the mid-60s, around 1965, 66, with a group, I think it was called the Ad Hoc Committee, the Veterans Ad Hoc Committee on the War in Vietnam, which later, a couple of decades later, sort of morphed into the Veterans for Peace. That ad hoc group marched as a group in some of the early demonstrations, and then emerging in 1967 at the April 15 march that ended up at the United Nations, the march where Dr. Martin Luther King spoke, where Benjamin Spock spoke. This is about, this was 11 days after Martin Luther King's magnificent oration on the war in Vietnam at the Riverside Church, an oration that virtually no Americans know about, and one that caused incredible attacks on him from the major media. Out of that small group of GIs at that march came the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. One of the founding members was Jan Barry, who had been at West Point, later became a journalist, and that became the most organized, most militant group during the war. And it grew incredibly all over the world. First, of course, it was mainly in U.S. Army units, then spread to the Marines, then to the U.S. Navy. And it was the largest, most organized anti-war movement in the military in U.S. history. There's no question. And that was fundamental, I would argue, as others have, after the Vietnamese resistance, that it was the resistance in the U.S. military, the refusal of soldiers to go out on these suicidal missions, the open demonstrations in the country, that, you know, iconic moment in, I think it was April 71, when GIs, some VVAW members, some others, threw their medals over the fence at the White House. That absolutely terrified the military authorities, and right up to Nixon and Kissinger, because they were facing an armed force that was refusing to do any more killing. And those are the GIs, by the way, when they say we should support and honor our troops, those GIs are not the ones that Obama meant when he was talking about supporting our troops. They're not going to be mentioned at all, and those are the ones that need to be honored.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by John Marciano. He is an anti-war and social justice activist and scholar, professor emeritus at SUNY Cortland, and the author of The American War in Vietnam, Crime or Commemoration. That's published by Monthly Review Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. John, another trope of the Vietnam War is that the media turned against the war, and that it was the media's coverage of the war in Vietnam that really opened the eyes of the U.S. public and created a momentum for the anti-war movement. To what degree is that true or, in fact, a myth?
Well, in terms of the mainstream media, it's simply not true. I think I might start with that there's a wonderful quote from Dan Rather that comes from his comment during the bombing of the former Yugoslavia, the wars in the Balkans at the end of the 20th century. He said, "I'm an American and I'm an American reporter. And yes, when there's combat involving Americans, you can criticize me if you must, damn me if you must, but I'm always pulling for us to win." I think that's the essence of the major media, as distinguished from the incredible, wonderful explosion in the 60s of the alternative media, where there were hundreds of local anti-war papers and hundreds of anti-war GI papers around the country and around the world. The myth, of course, is that the mainstream corporate media, then, of course, you know, pre-cable, so we're talking about CBS, NBC, ABC, and then Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Times, that they opposed and undermined the war effort. strictly in terms of the ends of the policy, the premises of U.S. foreign policy, the idea that the U.S. is a wonderful country, always going around the world spreading democracy. That's always been the premise of the major media in the country, including the New York Times. They were critical of some of the decisions that were made, some of the tactical issues, strategic issues. They became much more critical, of course, after the Tet Offensive in early 1968, when it became evident that the war was not going to be won. But before that, when you look at their editorials and you look at op-ed pieces for the most part, but especially the editorial positions, you find that they supported the war. They actually supported the war. And one of the iconic figures, of course, of this is Walter Cronkite, who for years supported the U.S. effort in Vietnam, even went on a bombing mission, either with the U.S. or maybe with the Australians. He was totally behind the U.S. effort, and then went to Vietnam after Tet unfolded and came back and made that very powerful broadcast. I think it was late February 1968, where he asked, you know, what's going on? There's a stalemate. He would have never made that broadcast had there not been the Tet Offensive and had not been clear that the war was not going to be won. So that's another one of the great myths, and that the war was in the living room of Americans night after night, with graphic scenes of carnage and violence, and particularly of U.S. soldiers. There have been media scholars have analyzed what we do have in terms of nightly broadcast, and that's simply untrue factually. That isn't, and because the argument is that turned the U.S., that turned people against the war. Well, it's actually not true, because people also ended up at times supporting U.S. troops more whenever they got to see some of those things. So the corporate media, which is continuing its role, by the way, its role basically to support U.S. policy, and all you got to do is read the Times, the L.A. Times, the Washington Post, read their editorials on what's been going on in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, etc. Not one of them is anti-war. There's not a chance. They just don't do it.
One of the things that you do in the American War in Vietnam, bearing in mind the ways that history, how history is remembered, has great political impact, is you write about the trajectory of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Now, I realize this is a very tall order and we don't have a lot of time, but I wonder if you can remind listeners, or perhaps tell them for the first time, about the key episodes of the war, starting with the entry of the United States into the region. Obviously, France was the colonial power preceding the United States.
Well, of course, the roots of the what the Vietnamese call the American War, of course, are in the history of the French domination of Vietnam, which began in the mid-19th century and was brutal, as French colonialism was there and in West Africa and in Algeria, as the British was. And, of course, it triggered a resistance against the French that eventually became led by the Indochina Communist Party, under the leadership of the great Vietnamese nationalist and communist, Ho Chi Minh. That continued until the Vietnamese, of course, declared their independence in September 1945. This was after the Vietnamese, of course, had to also struggle against the Japanese, which had occupied Indochina, but allowed the French to administer Vietnam. The Vietnamese declare their independence on September 2, 1945, where Ho quotes the U.S. Declaration of Independence. There are U.S. military officials from the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, at the celebration. The Vietnamese band plays the Star Spangled Banner. Well, after World War II, deals are cut, however, between the U.S. and the French and the British and the Chinese, then the nationalist government under Chiang Kai-shek, to take control of Vietnam. The British end up arming both French and Japanese troops to then fight against the Vietnamese resistance. I mean, think about that image. Japanese troops who had been killing American and British troops months before are now given arms to kill the Vietnamese. At that time, of course, that sparked the resistance by the Vietnamese, and it also sparked the first anti-war protest by U.S. citizens. That was merchant mariners in the fall of 1945, who had been supposed to transport U.S. troops back from France at the end of World War II. They were diverted to bring French troops back to Vietnam to recolonize that country. And they were members of the National Maritime Union. They were extremely upset. Many of them signed a letter and petitions to President Truman. It didn't go anywhere, of course. The French, of course, come back, attempt to recolonize Vietnam, elicit an even greater resistance, and are crushed at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. We have the Geneva Accords in 1954, international conference which organizes an election to unify the country. Everyone knows, including Eisenhower, that Ho Chi Minh would have won the election overwhelmingly. The U.S. sabotaged the election. CIA agents are in Vietnam to sabotage facilities as well. The U.S. goes ahead and establishes our man in Vietnam, in South Vietnam, President Diem, who was in power until 1963, when he is overthrown in a military coup that was orchestrated by the United States and some South Vietnamese generals. The main reason he was overthrown is because he had started making feelers to Ho Chi Minh and the North and the National Liberation Front and the war. Of course, that's on November 1st, 1963. 3 weeks later, John F. Kennedy is assassinated. Then you have, of course, a whole succession of military leaders in South Vietnam, culminated by our great friends General Chu and General Ki, who had been running drugs at different times in their lives for the French and then the Americans. And the Vietnamese resistance movement, some that had been in the National Liberation Front in the South, and increasingly regular North Vietnamese army troops liberate the country in April 30th, 1975. So that resistance movement, as I've said, is the key to the U.S. military defeat. Then, in terms of the United States, it's the anti-war movement and the military that was key. And then the domestic anti-war movement. So the Vietnamese essentially were at war that involved the U.S. directly or indirectly and then directly with the French, let's say from 1945 to 1975, 30 years of constant war. And if you go back through World War II, you add another number of years. And one, you know, when you read the histories of people having living underground for years, trying to survive U.S. bombing, it's an incredible there are those like Noam Chomsky, and I would agree with him. I think he's the foremost analyst of U.S. foreign policy in the world, saying that the Vietnamese really didn't win. The U.S. didn't gain its ultimate victory, that it's keeping South Vietnam anti-communist under our control, but so destroyed the Vietnamese, so devastated the country economically, politically, militarily, environmentally, that the Vietnamese were never able to move ahead with things they might have done if that had not happened. And I would suggest, just to finish, that's exactly what's happened, especially with Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and now Syria. All of these countries are so devastated that even if the U.S. leaves, they leave a legacy where countries are devastated for generations.
Mm. John Marciano is the author of The American War in Vietnam, Crime or Commemoration. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one of the things that tends to be missing in the ways that the Vietnam War is remembered today in the mainstream is the motivation for the U.S. involvement in the first place, of these stories of the honorable war, the noble cause. Having studied the conflict, having lived through the period and studied it extensively, what conclusions do you draw about that?
Well, I think essentially the roots of the war come from the effort of the U.S. to maintain its hegemony after World War II. I mean, I think it was an imperialist war, not in the narrow sense that the U.S. was going to extract huge resources from Vietnam and Indochina itself, but an imperial war in the sense that to maintain power, the United States had to crush independent third world revolutionary movements around the world. So in that sense, Vietnam is not unique. You can talk about Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, other areas of the world, where if nationalist movements emerge and control the resources and politics of their own country, they may end up being a threat to U.S. domination. So there are always deeper causes and reasons, not in a conspiratorial way. It's not a conspiracy. It's the people who make the decisions for the U.S. in the National Security Council, the Pentagon, the executive branch of government. They make the decisions for the country, and it's often called national security, national interests, national defense. But as Chomsky has argued, if you want to understand U.S. wars, you got to look at the domestic structure. Who sets foreign policy? What interests do they represent? What is the domestic source of their power? So it's not the United States as this abstract entity attacking Vietnam. It's the people who have power here who speak for the United States. And they're the people who never suffer in the wars. They're the people who don't fight the wars. They send others. And in terms of Vietnam, there was never a full-scale, democratic, open discussion and then vote on a declaration of war for the United States through our representatives in Congress. That never happened. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution, which was based on the lies of the Tonkin Gulf incident, which essentially didn't happen, was rushed through the Congress of the United States. Only two people voted against it, Senator Ernest Greening of Alaska, Senator Wayne Morris of Oregon, here in Oregon. The vote in the Senate, I think, was 88-2. In the House, it was something like 403-0. That was not a full-scale discussion of a declaration of war as mandated very clearly in the U.S. Constitution. Congress shall declare war. And, of course, there has been no declaration of war by this country since the beginning of World War II. None of the wars we're involved now have involved a real discussion, not resolutions. The founding fathers were very careful about their language. They didn't say Congress shall have a resolution about war. Congress shall declare war. So U.S. forces are involved in bombing and on the ground all over the world, and there's been no declaration of war whatsoever, which is patently against the U.S. Constitution.
Well, let's talk about the legacy of the Vietnam War as it pertains to the multiple wars of today. Critics have talked about the Vietnam syndrome being one legacy of the Vietnam War, that is, that the American public was made reticent to support wars after the debacle of Vietnam. And yet, of course, we see multiple wars now. Do you think that the American state has been effective in pushing away people's doubts about supporting war, or do you think it's more complicated than that?
Oh, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. Given the propaganda out of Washington, the subservience of the national corporate media, of course, the absolute terrorist attack on September 11th, 2001, which a number of people argued the United States should have responded as a massive, heinous criminal act and gone after the people who were responsible. But of course, as other people have mentioned, that might have meant the United States has to go after one of its own biggest allies in Saudi Arabia. That has created a climate in which the power is so vested now in the executive branch. Congress, I would argue, is essentially irrelevant. There's been no opposition whatsoever to any of these major wars, even though the fairly close vote on the resolution for the Iraq War before that began. But again, that was not a declaration of war decision. And I would add that many of the people, there were, who knows, it might have been in the millions in the United States, it certainly was around the world, before the Iraq invasion in January 2003, many people who were anti-war and who opposed what Bush was doing and Cheney and that administration simply faded away after the war started, and that their energy against war, I would argue, was very partisan. They did not challenge John Kerry on his position on the war. They did not challenge and have not challenged Barack Obama on the wars that he has involved the United States. So I think my position, which bothers some of my liberal left friends, is that the Democratic Party has sucked the air and the energy out of the anti-war movement in the country, and people who find it appalling that the Republicans would do such nasty things somehow shut their eyes when the Democrats do.
One frequently hears that whatever you think of any conflict, you still have to support American troops. You're critical of that notion. Can you tell us why?
Well, it's a tough issue, evidently, as I've said before. I mean, I was in the anti-war movement. My brother was in combat. I've worked with veterans, combat veterans, since the 1960s. I'm now an associate member of the Veterans for Peace. In our local chapter here in the Rogue Valley, our Vietnam veterans, combat veterans. one does not take lightly the idea that you don't support the people from your own community and your own country when they're put in harm's way. On the other hand, what's very dangerous about that is it really, the real message is you are not supposed to dissent from the policies. And as we know from the history of the GI movement against the war in Vietnam, the strongest dissent against that war came from veterans, combat veterans in Vietnam and veterans around the world, some of whom had been in Vietnam and came back to organize at places like Fort Bragg and others. So that was very legitimate. Those are the veterans you need to support, while at the same time understanding that we create the conditions today, even though we don't have a formal draft, we have an economic draft. Graduates of Stanford and Harvard and Yale and the State University of New York are not enlisting to go to Afghanistan or Iraq or even Syria, where there are American boots on the ground. So it's an economic draft. So the people with the least amount of power in this country are the ones who sacrifice for the people for the most power. But it's a very seductive siren song to support the troops, because that means we have to support the war. And somehow the warrior has to be separated from the war.
John Marciano is an anti-war activist and scholar, author of The American War in Vietnam, Crime or Commemoration. That's published by Monthly Review Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's also co-author of Teaching the Vietnam War, and he's professor emeritus at SUNY Cortland. John, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Sasha.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.